start the show. 1047, here we go.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Pretty good, that's the best one yet.
I am short.
Pizza, pizza.
Pizza! Showtime!
I flashed a 70-year-old woman.
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. But ain't no funny daddies that'll link it bad. For the show link, go direct to DLNGS.org. MICGLinuxLink.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the calendar's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 1047 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show today, we have Joe.
Yep, that's me.
And special guest, if he remains on, More Nancy.
Hello, everyone.
It's been a little while, and I suspect Joe will be coming in late today, and Dave has got the ick. So there's that. Now, Joe, I have hopefully... You, and maybe you too, More Dancy. I'm not going to rule you out. Maybe you can like throw me some advice on this, but, cause it's something I haven't done in a while, but I just, finishing up some projects at work. And one of the things that is coming my way, a request is that I think the past couple of months, we've been having situations crop up where they call them bad actors, but I'm not sure it's really bad actors. It's, somebody starts scraping our stuff, and as they go back through the catalog and following all the links and everything, it starts to really pull on the CDNs where they're scraping the images and the videos and everything. And it's like whacking our costs for, bandwidth transfer and stuff like that. And it gets really excessive. So I guess it happened again last week, but I was out on vacation. Now I was somewhat aware of this situation going on, and I think it's affecting like across the board, but two of the CDNs are ones that are technically under the purview of the group I am part of. So there is a desire to kind of nip this in the bud before it gets too excessive. What they have been doing is when this problem starts, they identify the IP addresses or whatever and then go ahead and block them. Which is kind of like, I guess, the standard procedure. I know around the holidays, and I think a lot of this is coming out of India and Pakistan, and they decided at first to block entire subnets from those regions, which inadvertently ended up causing problems for some of our offshore developers that are in those locations, where if they weren't on the VPN, or even sometimes when they were on the VPN, it was causing problems with them to be able to test. They didn't have access to certain things because they were being blocked. Now I know that you can do that level of stuff, whitelisting and blacklisting and blocking and all that. But it's been a really long time since I had to do anything like that. And kind of like what they're interested in right now is setting up monitoring that when we start seeing this excessive level of pulling from significant jump in our traffic to the CDNs, that could be an indication that this is going on again. And it's pulling stuff that normally doesn't get pulled a lot, which is, why it's busting through the cache, because it's not in cache. You know, it hasn't been in there because nobody accesses it. But if you go back for like 5-10 years of articles, you start pulling a ton of stuff off those CDNs, which incurs a hefty cost in the transfer. Now, they don't have direct access to the CDN. Where Fastly is in front of it. So it's not like they have the direct access to the origin that they could bypass the Fastly caching. Cause that's all restricted and everything. But I'm just curious, like, is there better ways of doing stuff like this now than IP address blocking?
Honestly, well, I would start with the IP address blocking as a quick fix, but QoS as well.
I'm sorry, what's that?
QoS, quality of service, some kind of just limiting if something is just eating up that kind of bandwidth, just knock it down with that. I mean, well, they have to have some kind of handshake to be able to get on, right?
Well, basically, what we're essentially dealing with is we have Google storage buckets, which host the image or video files. They're on there. And then it's on the front end, it's just the Fastly service. Fastly is a customized varnish layer, which sits in front of our content and a lot of the applications, the front ends and everything. It all pretty much goes through Fastly. So it's not, I don't know how we would put QoS on there because we're not serving it. We're not like, we don't operate the servers and the technology that actually serves the images. It's
so
a,
they're calling it bad actors. But, I mean, do they have any idea what is accessing it? Did somebody implement some kind of new backup system or something? Is it at a regular time?
No, it happens. Like, it just, what it sounds like is, somebody's out there scraping our stuff. Like they go through and they scrape our stuff and pull all that content. And when they end up doing that, because we have hundreds of sites.
So
and
it's public facing.
Yes, it's public facing.
Okay. Is there any way to, limit how much gets downloaded at one time?
That's a good question. It's a tough question to ask because the team that I am on manages the back end applications, primarily the content management system that the journalists and editors use to put in their articles. We also happen to be in control of the CDN. And so the front end to all of this that is public facing to our to the subscribers and to the visitors that aren't the journalists and editors working in the CMS, that's a whole other team. But the content that they end up having to consume, the images and videos, are under our purview. So I guess it really does make it challenging that we're at the mercy of the tools of the third party services that we're taking advantage of. Because I can't think of how will we be able to implement that level of limiting, because we don't control the front end.
Well, you figure Google would provide some kind of way to do that.
And again, there might be some stuff. I haven't had the opportunity to fully investigate this yet. So there's no, like right now, what we have in place is that there is no direct access to that content. It has to come through Fastly, which then I'm like, the challenge is how do you then differentiate legitimate traffic from these bad actors without trying to identify, without being, is there a, I guess what I'm trying to think of, is there a more proactive way than being reactive, which is to wait until the problem happens, to identify the IP addresses that are causing the problem and then block them and hope that they don't shift to another subnet?
Add a captcha. I don't know.
Add a captcha. I mean, if it was all behind a paywall, then we wouldn't have this problem, I guess.
Right. If it wasn't public facing. The only thing I can think, yeah, some kind of captcha to limit it. Yeah, this is a tough one, man.
It is. And you know what? As I was thinking about it, I'm like, why the hell would, why, what's the advantage of scraping all that information? And one of the things that crossed my mind is, I'm wondering if they're doing that, scraping that information to train AI.
Yeah. I suppose that's possible. I mean, gather all the information that you can and store it somewhere.
Yeah, run it through some, like, somebody's working on AI stuff and then they want to train it that way. Why not? Scrape all that content out there and just rip it through there. That'd be pretty interesting. Like, I'm like, what else are they going to do with this content?
What is the content?
Articles. Like news articles.
Okay.
I mean, if you're, like, that's the thing. It's like, if you're going to scrape all that content, what are you actually going to do with it? It's not like you're getting, it's all public information. Pretty much public. Obviously, it's public information because they could scrape it. But, like, right. Why? Like, what is? What was? Would somebody want to do with all that information? And the only thing I could think of was, you know, it'd be great to train AI on if you could pull all that information in and run it. You know, train your AI bot on that. There you go. Otherwise, I'm like, I'm kind of at a loss as to, I don't think they could resell it or republish it somewhere. Some of that's really old. I don't know why it would be useful.
I don't either. But yeah, no, that you make a good point that it could be really useful for AI if they're good articles, then, you know.
Even maybe. If they're not good articles, it'd still be useful for AI, I guess.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's an easy way to train stuff. I mean, oh, yeah.
Now, the only things I can think of is limiting how much an IP can download per hour, which would have to be done through Google, or implementing a captcha on your page, all your pages, but, ugh.
Oh gosh. What have I been using? What was I using recently? I think it was some Google service too. It's like every time I would try to do or want to go do something on it, I have to answer a click that thing that says I'm not a robot, and then it asks me to click on all the images that don't have a traffic light or a motorcycle or whatever. I find those they're so freaking annoying.
They are actually really annoying. I know what you're getting at there, but it's something that Google does if you're using like a VPN. They want to make sure that you're actually a human.
And maybe that's what I'm hitting. I ran through it like 3 or 4 times this past week, and I'm trying to remember now what it was. And it was like, I was taken aback at first because I'm like, I don't ever remember having this level of frequency of having to do this.
Yeah, well, if I'm using a public VPN, like, not a public VPN, but like, you know, from a company, if I'm using someone else's VPN as opposed to my own, it's a known VPN IP range. So, like, every time I go to do a Google search, like any Google search, I have to click, yes, I'm
really?
A human, and I have to click on the image, yes.
That is interesting. I don't think it was a Google search that was hitting me with that, but,
But yeah, it's fun.
I know what it was. Oh, I know what it was. So, we have a number of Google Cloud functionings running in 3 separate environments. So there's probably like, I think like 12 cloud functions. And cloud function is like an on-demand application. So it's either backed by a trigger that's HTTPS or a PubSub trigger that when it's triggered, it just, they run it on their cloud run servers. It's just a simple application and it does whatever it does and then it's done. So instead of having like a VM running all the time, it's just something that runs rather quickly on demand. What it basically is just a container that is ready to be spun up and handle that request like right away. And it's pretty fast. Like, if you don't have a container running, if it's not like active at the time and a request comes in, it's usually up and handling that request within like a second or two. So it does it pretty fast. But the way that it ends up being deployed is that they have what's called Google Source Repositories. It's similar to GitHub. It's just a source code repository that they host. And so we use GitHub, but you can sync your GitHub repository to the Google Source Repository, set up a webhook to do that, that whenever you make a commit in your GitHub repository, that gets pushed up to the Google Cloud Source Repository. And what we've been experiencing is that somewhere between 3 weeks to maybe 2 months, it stops syncing. And we have to go in and either perform a manual sync, and if the manual sync doesn't revive it, we have to destroy the source repository and recreate it. And it's kind of annoying because there's no indication of that this happens. So when we do like our updates to the functions and we push some stuff out, we expect that it's going to work as it should. And of course it deploys and everything, but what ends up happening is that unless you're paying careful attention, it might not have synced up to the cloud repository, source repository, and therefore you're just redeploying what's already there, instead of all the updates that you may have done, which are in the GitHub repository. So after this 3 or 4 go rounds of this, we had a problem where we upgraded our application, our one function, to Node 20, and there's a bug in one of the dependent libraries of this library called Get Video Duration that we use to when we process videos or we pull them in, it pulls out the duration of the video and stores that
along with all the rest of the metadata information for it in our content system. And what ended up happening was, in moving to Node 20, it was a newer version of the library that was being used. And that newer version was linked to what is called FFProbe installer, which is pulling in a binary of FFmpeg and FFProbe, which is what's used to pull out the video duration on there. That binary appears to not be compatible with the newer operating system images, particularly the one that we're using in the Google Cloud Function, which is an Ubuntu image. And I'm trying to remember. It's the long-term release image, and it's not that old, but it's been around for a while. And apparently whatever that binary that they pull for that, where they're getting it from, is statically linked to a specific library version, which has been updated in these newer images, and the source of where they're pulling it from has not updated yet, and it's been going on for like over a year. And so we found that the library allows you to, as opposed to using that FFProbe binary that it installs, if FFmpeg is installed on the base image itself, you could use that installation version of FFProbe instead of the one that it's pulling. And we implemented that, and locally it worked fine. And so it was pushed out, and the guy that I was working with is like, this was last week. Cause I'm like, man, I know I tested this crap and I know it works, right? And he tested it and we got it working and we're like, okay, we're doing this. And he pushed it out last week. I went on vacation. He hits me up. He's like, it's not working again. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's not working. So when I came back on Monday, it's like, we went through all the steps, like pulled down the image, which it's pretty cool because you can go into the console on the artifact repository. They have container repositories in there, and under the GCF, which is Google Cloud Function repository, it has all the Docker images that are created, which you can do a Docker pull to get those images, and then I can run them and test them locally, which is how we knew that it was working just fine. Like, it should work just fine, because FFmpeg is installed on that image and FFProbe is there, and thus it should work. But what ended up happening is, as I looked further into it, I'm like, wait a minute. The code change that we made to specify to use FFProbe that's installed on the container in the operating system, as opposed to the one that the library pulls in, was not there. Which I'm like, what's going on? And then that's when I looked, and sure enough, the Google Cloud source repository had not synced since the 1st of March. And the last update we did was like last week, right, in April. And so since this is in three environments, I then discovered that in one of the environments, it had not synced since January 31st, which was even older. So all of this was fixed by simply manually syncing it. And then once we did that on all of those environments, it kicked that auto sync back in again. And it's been fine this past couple of days. But I did a search on the web and I could not find anybody having this kind of problem. So I went to Google support discussion groups, because that is where the free support is. Like, we don't get direct access. Like, there's a certain team that has direct access to Google's paid Google support. It's not too often that I get to use that. So I went to that, and That is where I got the CAPTCHA, Joe. That's right. So I posted my problem on the Google support group for cloud source repositories and developer tools. And, it was there for a day. And then I got a response and from, an actual Google person, like support person, who said very kind of unhelpfully, like, read the Google, GitHub mirroring documentation, and if that doesn't solve your problem and you're still having an issue, file a bug report.
Read the manual, then come back.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I've read the manual. I told you we had it working. I told you that it just suddenly stops working. And I told you that sometimes it's revived by a manual sync or otherwise we have to recreate it. Why is this problem happening? Like, could I have a little more maybe support or whatever it is instead of just automatically filing a bug? But whatever. It's really annoying.
Pretty much. Oh, well, I have had some fun. Some of it work-related, but I don't know if I want to, how much I want to get into the whole hiring process and the whole onboarding process with work.
So you got new team members?
No, oh. I don't. I'm four team members down. I had a guy recently quit, and I can't get a backfill.
Oh, wait a second. Who are you, what are you doing with the onboarding and stuff like that if it's not for your team?
That's the whole problem, is we're not onboarding. I mean, seriously, we are four people down and we're being told that, either we're not getting anybody or we might get, two contractors, despite the fact that we have a guy that was formerly on the team, barely needs any training to, you know, get him back up to speed. And is more than willing and happy to come back. Wants to be on the team. I mean, contractors are extremely 50-50 on whether or not, you know, they're going to suck.
Right.
And here we have a guy that I know knows the dang job and will do it well. And they're just like, no. Have a contractor, maybe. We'll see. Give us another week. So, and then, you know, I've got this, this team that, is upset that we didn't respond to something, you know, in any time frame. And then I go in and I look at the definition of the job to see what the action should have been. And it says that the failure action is no action required. Okay. He didn't like that answer, and so then I dug a little bit deeper into this particular application. And there was a request to onboard this application 2 years ago, which was denied. So we don't support the monitoring of this application. And he's upset that we aren't monitoring it. Huh. Figure that one out.
Why won't, like, is this person working in another
state.
Part of the company?
No, he's dev side. But because we're not supporting it, that means that the development team has to support it.
No.
And, he's like, well, we're not going to be available on the holiday and we need someone to monitor this. And it's like, well, they would need to be onboarded and, we're not onboarding anything right now while I'm four people down. I'm sorry. I can't take on more work. That's just the way it is. He didn't like that answer either. So I'm sure I'll hear more about it tomorrow.
I'll contract.
But, oh, dude, if I had any say in the hiring process, believe me, you would be there. You saying that right there, I would have you there.
at least a 51 to 49% chance that I'm okay.
Yeah, I know you're having another health scare.
No, I'm not scared.
Well, assume the world will spin on until it doesn't anymore. Right? But I also have had some fun doing things at home. I've had that pie hole set up for a couple of years now with wire guard on it, and it's just a Pi Zero W, so it's all hooked up over Wi-Fi and everything. And it's worked pretty well, but very, very limiting for the wire guard on the speed. So for the show for Mintcast this weekend, I've migrated to a mini PC, this old gigabit bricks, or gigabyte bricks that I had sitting around that I paid like, you know, $20 for.
What are the specs on those?
Oh, it's an A8. Let me bring that up real quick. I do have that information.
What's it called?
Gigabit bricks.
BRIX?
I think it's BRIX, but it's okay. Gigabyte. B-Y.
Oh, gigabyte. Yeah, there we go.
It's A8-5545M APU. So it's not real powerful or anything, but I had used it as a thin client for a while out here in my garage, so I know it'll do the job.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, it's like 10 times faster than the Raspberry Pi in regards to the WireGuard. And I also set up Nextcloud on it, and just as a backup. And I'm thinking that it's also going to replace the Dell Latitude that I have in the living room as a set-top box right now, which will allow me to, you know, reclaim that and finally fix the screen on it and actually use it as a tablet like it's meant to be used.
That's so nice.
But then again, I was also thinking about, you know, migrating it all to that tablet because, well, slightly less power consumption, but really an equal amount of power. And, you know, I've already got a USB-C dongle on it that provides wired Ethernet that has a couple of extra USB-C ports. Or not USB-C ports, but just USB ports. So I could hook up the external drive for the Nextcloud and have it up and running in very little time. But no, I don't want to do it all again right now, so I'll just use the bricks. But yeah, I made a lot of mistakes setting it up in regards to like just the general setup, and it should not have been as difficult as I made it. So I'll be going through all of my mistakes on it this weekend. But I'm wondering what else I can set up on it since it's a little bit more powerful than that Pi Zero, just to, you know, make my life easier.
What are you interested in setting up?
I don't know, because I don't use BT Sync anymore, and that would be the obvious choice. So with Nextcloud already on there and WireGuard on there and a DNS sinkhole, what else do I really need? I mean, nothing else I really need to back up. What do you think would be good on there? I mean, I could set it up to actually be my DNS server instead of just my sinkhole. But I can't think of anything, because that function is built into Pi-hole. And the script for Pi-hole was nice once I got around its operating system limitations. And then I had to find WireGuard Manager, which is a script very similar to the WireGuard script on the Pi, but it works with Linux Mint. So.
Man, what? You can set up an email server.
That sounds like torture, honestly.
It's a fun experience until it's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
And then when you after you've been running it for like almost two decades, you realize it's pretty much a spam hole.
Yeah. Yeah, spend all your time finding new things that you have to block.
Yeah, that's... You do an IRC server.
Yeah.
And then,
or a mumble server.
Then they can come and tell you to go to irc.supernets.com where all the hot action is.
I'm surprised people are still using IRC.
Aren't we all?
I mean, I was using that in the 90s as a teenager.
Yeah, I remember, like, I used to spend a lot of time on IRC.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people that I used to talk with on IRC, and it's just, I guess now it's the Discord these days that all the kids are using.
Yeah, well, I remember being on IRC and you know, just running like four chats at the same time and switching back and forth between them all and keeping all the conversations just organized in my head so I wasn't saying the wrong thing in the wrong window. And now I can't even do that with Skype.
Or Slack. And hello.
Ah, there's Joel.
Hey, Joel.
Joelie with his slacking.
That's what I do at work all day.
Yeah, we use Slack too, but yeah, IRC was.
It's better than ServiceNow.
Oh, anything's better than ServiceNow.
Oh there my God, we're switching to ServiceNow. Quit reminding me.
There you go, Joe. Sorry. You can run your own version, a test version of ServiceNow on your system. That's what you need.
My biggest problem with ServiceNow is I wish it had a actual viable, workable mobile app. It doesn't.
I wish it was viable and workable itself. It isn't.
Well, that too. That too.
You know what? Maybe I'm not being fair to ServiceNow because I can't imagine that the application is really that bad. I think it's just how it's being implemented in our company that it's bad. This is what I truly think. Okay, go ahead, Joel, and then I'll tell you what I truly think.
Well, see, what I want to say is I think it tries to do too many things all at once because it can be used to manage changes, to do projects, and to take service tickets. And I think it tries to do too much.
Yeah, and I think what the problem is in the way that it's implemented in my company is that they really went out of their way to identify specific workflows that happen on a frequent basis that then they wanted to give those people that have to request those workflows an easy way to do that. So therefore, there's a list of workflows, and be it I need to create a new user account, or I need to, you know, terminate a user account, or I need to give access to X, Y, or Z. And they have that all set up where you put in a few bits of information and then it generates all the stuff that needs to be generated to all the, groups that need to handle certain specific parts of that request. Whereas when I go in, I'm not there are specific things that I need to do, which are not captured in those workflows. And therefore, they don't give you the ability to just open a ticket. You have to follow
one of these 20 or 30 workflows, and if your request doesn't fit in there, you're kind of screwed.
Mm-hmm. Or I get cases like one of the domain teams that actually know, like, financial aid and stuff like that. They'll put in what they call a case task for us. But then say we find out through the case test that, hey, they need to run some queries. Well, that's going to run, since we're making a change to the system, deleting data or something like that, that requires us to write a change. I cannot write a change off a case test. I have to write it off of a case or a case project, which is stupid. You know, I'm like, I understand that, but you should be able to me, you should be able to initiate anything from anywhere, but that's not how it is. At least not how we've implemented it.
I've seen it poorly implemented at two of my previous jobs, and I've seen it implemented where everything flows together. All the templates for the service requests and tickets and all that, or change requests are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and then there's RITMs, which are like, you know, when you're wanting to activate somebody's account or to order a laptop or something like that. You know, those are managed through there too. Everything's managed through there. It's a pain in the butt. But at least I don't have to use Clarity anymore, which is SAP Clarity, I think, if I remember right. That was what I used to use when I was in professional services to document my time. So that would be documenting billable hours to the client. And, even when I first came into, the global support team that I'm a part of now, I still had to fill out my time card in there. Now I don't have to do that anymore. Thank God. But enough about that. I got a new toy for my birthday.
What'd you get?
I got a cricket.
What the hell's a cricket?
I'll tell you. It's a machine that basically will cut. Usually it's vinyl, but it can be other things. Like it could be cardboard or fabric or something like that, depending on what blade you have loaded. But the typical thing that people do with it is they'll make things like stickers or t-shirts, like an iron-on t-shirt thing. And it's not quite like the old puffy iron-ons that, like we grew up with, like in the 70s with the puffy, letters and stuff like that. It's,
okay.
It's actually vinyl. It's not as good as a screen print. You know, Tom Radancy's, thing, you know, those, what we've had from there, from that he made years ago now, like decade ago now, those are a much higher quality than what this does, but this is still, not too bad quality wise. It actually comes out pretty good.
What's it called?
Cricut, C-R-I-C-U-T. All right. Unfortunately, there's no Linux client, big surprise, you know, but there is apps for it as well as, on both iOS and Android. So, it's pretty nifty. I've made like about 4 or 5 t-shirts already. The t-shirt price I was getting at Hobby Lobby or Michael's is, about $3 per t-shirt. Media costs a little more depending on what you're using. But there's a huge, huge following around it, especially, with the ladies. Not so much the guys, but I dig it. I don't care. Wife, I actually, thought it was a good idea and I made a t-shirt for Luke already.
There's a print, wait.
It's a plotter. It's really big in the, scrapbooking community.
It's absolutely big in there. Yeah, you can't like you said, as plotter, you can also use it to draw things with a marker as well. A plotter. Yeah. So usually it's cutting things out of vinyl. That's usually the thing that you're cutting out of.
And then you apply this to a shirt with an iron or something?
If you have the iron-on version of it, yes. Oh. Yes. So basically, when you cut it, instead of cutting it like when you pull it off it would read normally, you mirror it. And then you have to pick all the pieces of the vinyl out of it that you're not using. So basically, like, say if it has a letter, O, you have to pick the middle of the O out and all the vinyl around that O if you were only printing an O. But, you know, so it's called weeding. But, you probably could use open source tools to design for it as long as you had like a PNG file, like a transparent PNG. You should be able to import it into the app, in order to, use it. Now, I also got the, press that's used which is basically a huge iron. And the weirdest one, I got the latest one. I kind of wish I would have got the one version behind, because for some silly reason they decided that the Easy Press 3, which is what I've got to go along with it, requires a Bluetooth connection to a phone or a device of some sort in order to activate it. It's kind of silly on that. It doesn't need that. But, you know, if you don't have a functioning brain, I guess it's okay because it walks you through the entire process of, for most of the t-shirts, it was 5 seconds, press it for 5 seconds at 315. And then you lay down the iron-on sheet, and then you press it for 30 seconds. And my experience has been it needs a little bit longer on it, especially around the edges, so that the edges will stick to the shirt. But then after that, you let it cool down, and then you peel the carrier away from the shirt, and then you have a shirt. And you can do things with it. Like I've done, I did my first double-layer t-shirt this week with it. And it came out okay. I have to tweak the design a little bit because some of the
layers
text...
to give you multiple colors or something.
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, Joe, you can see that I posted the picture of it on Facebook. So,
but, I suppose I should go look at Facebook.
Yeah, maybe. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. You know, fortunately, I would say price-wise, it's probably right in there about, well, the total was like $700 for all the stuff. So, you know, but the production is more along the lines of the same cost as like a 3D printer. More or less, it just depends on what you're making. So, like, I made a sticker for my Crick or Circle water bottle. It says go hiking on it. So that worked really nice. I made a couple t-shirts with my call sign on it.
Cool.
I'm surprised my wife let me spend that much money. We have money left over from our tax refund.
Well, happy birthday, Joel. Did you have a good time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't go out or anything, but I figured we'll just go out later.
You know, wait, what's the place you like? It's not Texas Roadhouse, is it?
It is.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's a Texas Roadhouse? Or... For some reason, I was thinking Beefsteak Charlie, but I don't think that place is in business anymore, is it?
No.
Oh, that was like an 80s place, wasn't it?
Or like Bennigan's.
That's Beefsteak Charlie's. Are they still around? Oh, it's a Manhattan restaurant.
There I put a link to the double layer t-shirt I made. One thing I need to get a one of those folding tables that folds in the middle so it folds down more compactly so that when I'm doing t-shirt presses up here, I can lay it out on that and have a little bit more space to work with. But if you look at that picture, the word courageous is kind of overlapping Joshua 1:9. I didn't want that to happen, so I kind of shrunk the space up. So if I do this one again, which I probably will, the courageous word won't overlay that bottom Joshua 1:9 text. So it came out pretty good. There's a couple little wrinkles in it, in the word afraid, but you can't really see them when you have it on. And I think it's just because I overheated it a little bit when I was putting on the second layer. So, you also do like window stickers for your car. If you wanted to do those stupid stick figures for your car, yeah, I guess you could do that if you wanted to. I wouldn't do that. I guess you could probably also do like, a Calvin sticker if you wanted to. I just realized this. My office windows was open the whole time I was at church. And it's raining.
Did it rain in your office?
I have to go look over there. It might have. It'll be alright though. It hasn't been raining real hard. Although it wasn't like the week before last, I think. Was it the week before last? No, it was the first week in April. The first Wednesday in April. Tuesday in April. We had like over 2 inches of rains. That's when they literally closed school because there might be a tornado. And we never got one, but. And I don't mean close early, like they didn't even meet all day. But anywho, Joe, I thought I asked Joe, did you get to see the eclipse where you were?
Yeah, absolutely. Went out in my front yard.
Were you in totality down there?
Yes.
Awesome. I didn't have any glasses.
Oh man, I saw. Not only did I get to see the eclipse, Joel, which was about 85 to 90%.
Yep, we were 99.4.
So not only did I, but there were 3 rocket launches off of Waltz. Where I got to go down to the beach see those. Yes, there were sounding rockets. Couldn't really see anything until they were up. And then it almost looked like a jet, but it was going a lot faster. So they had 3 rocket launches during the eclipse, each for about 45 minutes apart, starting at 2:40 till, like 4:30. So that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
I went north to Marion, and we had about, give or take 10 minutes of totality.
Awesome.
That's cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what the eeriest thing was the temperature drop here. I mean, it literally, I'd say between 5 to 6 degrees.
It dropped a couple of degrees here too while we were sitting out watching it. You could feel it dropping.
Yeah. No, I did have the glasses and part of the time I needed to use it, but, there was some also cloud cover that was rolling in. So for a chunk of it, you couldn't use the glasses at all because it was just black. And then so you take the glasses off and you can see it through the cloud cover. And it also made it really easy to take pictures of it.
Yep. Yep. I went looking like way too late. Like I took off at lunchtime to go see if I could find a pair of glasses, but I couldn't. And I didn't have a filter for my camera either, but I did try to take a couple drone shots, and didn't kill the camera on the drone in the process. So that was good. Micro doesn't seem to care too much about sunlight. I've taken pictures of the sun many times with it inadvertently, you know, just for doing a when doing like a one of my favorite things to do with the drone is do a photosphere, which is basically 34 pictures in 360 degrees. And you can do many things with that. My favorite thing to do with that is to make what they call a tiny planet, which basically makes what looks like a ball out of all the pictures. And it looks really cool. But unfortunately, I didn't have either the sun filter or ND filter, so at its closest point of totality for us, I really couldn't capture it. So you can see the corona like you could on so many other pictures, but I mean, it was an incredible, experience because we were also in the path, in 2017, but it was far darker this time. Our streetlights came on where we were. I'm sure it did where Joe was too, but
yeah.
And we might be dead by the time it happens again.
What, 20 years from now?
It's longer than that.
It was like 24 years from now.
Well, it depends where you're at, of course, too. But I think we got next March, I think there's supposed to be a total lunar eclipse in our area. Have you ever seen one of those?
Hey, what?
Have you ever seen a lunar eclipse?
I don't think I have. When is that supposed to happen? Well, you know, I don't know. I think the last time there was a lunar eclipse like that was possible to view, it was cloudy.
Okay. And that one you really, you don't want to have the clouds during it. When I was in, fourth or fifth grade, it was right after I got a telescope for a birthday one year. I don't have it anymore. I think I got rid of it because it was broke, and it was a cheap Kmart brand telescope, you know, because that's, you know, so it wasn't really very good to begin with, but it was falling apart, and I think before I threw it out, I did at least hook it up, and take the lens cap off and tried to take it out and use it, and I couldn't even see through it, so. But I got it for a birthday, and it's either that summer after my birthday, or, I don't know, it would probably be 1982 or 1983 when that happened. And our apartment, the steps of our apartment were just perfect viewing. We can see the moon right from the steps on our apartment, and it turns blood red when it goes into the Earth's shadow, and was really neat. I'll see if I can find what date that was.
Dun, dun, dun.
Was it December of 82? I remember it being warm when it happened.
I don't ever remember seeing.
Oh, yes. Actually, there was 6 eclipses in 1982, counting solar eclipses. But all the solar ones were partial. And there was 2 lunar eclipses. One of them was in July in 82. But does it say where? I'll see if that December or July one is the one. But I do remember seeing that when I was a kid. I was fourth or fifth grade. So.
Well, apparently, next year, on March 14th,
there should be a total lunar eclipse that I guess will be visible for the North and South America. I think I'm trying to read this map to...
Yeah, 13th through the 14th.
Yeah, yeah. So it looks like it's going to be, you know, if you're in North and South America, well, all of North America, it looks like maybe not Alaska, or parts of Alaska, and then the western part of South America should be able to see it. And then the 7th through the 8th of September, it looks like the total lunar eclipse will be visible in Europe, Australia, Africa.
Yep.
There is a partial eclipse on the 17th and 18th of this year.
I might have to go. Well, fortunately for that, you don't need anything special. I might see if I can't get a bigger lens by then, maybe.
What the hell is a penumbral lunar eclipse?
Penumbral.
What does that mean?
Well, you can go see. It takes place when the moon moves through the faint outer part of the Earth's shadow, the penumbra. So just on the edge of the Earth's shadow.
Yeah, I'm trying to see whether the site I'm looking at, I would assume that the shaded part would be what the eclipse is, but I'm not 100% clear. Anyway, I'm excited. I'll have to keep that eye out for that next year.
Well, yeah.
And the one on the 17th or 18th, the partial eclipse.
Yeah, I want to know what time it'll be. That's what I want to know. You know. Because if it's happening in the middle of the night, you know. What's this? Lunar eclipse countdown, 337 days, 2 hours... and 10 minutes, and it starts at 3:57 a.m., or 3:57, I should say, UTC. So it's like 3 in the morning.
Well, wait a second. This says it's supposed to, the one on September 18th, the partial lunar eclipse, is supposed to start at 12:41 UTC, which would be what? 9 o'clock?
Something like it, yeah.
Oh, wait, no, wait. 4 hours, 8 o'clock, 8:41.
That wouldn't be too bad.
What time is the one next year? Oh, that one's at 3:57. Yeah, so that would be like around, if you're going to look at it here, it would be 11 o'clock. That's not too bad.
Nah.
12 o'clock, because it's going to be like 3:57. A.M. So it'd be like 11:57 A.M. Oh, damn! Oh my goodness, almost quitting time.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
It's actually 10 o'clock, 10:57. So about 11 o'clock. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was one of the neatest things. I'm going to have to probably see if I can't do like a time lapse of that. That would be neat. Friend of mine, he's a ham radio operator, okay? And I have friends that were invited to my wedding, but they had to tell me they couldn't come to my wedding because they were going to his wedding because it was the exact same day and year. So, but he is an amateur radio operator as well as an amateur astronomer, and he had a heck of a setup. He did get the diamond ring effect from the solar eclipse, as well as I think he also got the pearls as well. But I guess it was also some fairly large prominences that you could see in totality. The little red dots all around the corona. That's what that was. But I wish I would have had the glasses, though. Oh, it would have been so cool.
I had like 5 extra pairs over here, Joel. If I would have known.
Yeah, well, you know what I was thinking? I was thinking it was going to be like it was last time when it happened. For weeks afterward, they had tons of these at the stores yet. I was thinking that there would still be some left, but boy, was I wrong. In our area, they literally closed school on Monday for that. But in a little bit more open news, I upgraded the antennas on my Meshtastic nodes, and I was finally able to detect a signal that wasn't one of my mesh nodes. A guy flying his drone in Westerville, Ohio, which is 20 miles away to my house in Grove City. His drone was flying at 400 feet. Found that out because there is a Central Ohio Meshtastic group. I posted a screenshot of the app asking if anybody knew who that was, and the guy who owned it told me that was his drone, and I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Meshtastic is LORA, which, what does that mean? I need to double check what that means. It's a LoRa, is LoRaWAN is IoT solution for long range and remote area coverage. So it was originally started for being an IoT solution. So these are essentially running on ESP32 microcontrollers. The ones I have are the Heltec version 3. And those came with like a little tiny antenna and a little tiny case. But I upgraded to 3dB antennas, which gives me a little bit more gain on the antenna. And finally was able to see a couple nodes that were not my own. We didn't talk on them because you can send text messages over them. But I just was able, my nodes were able to connect to them. So, but it's a pretty neat technology. There's other uses for them as well. Both of my nodes have Bluetooth as well and Wi-Fi on them. But from what I've read, you can only have one active at a time. I think you have to put one of them in a routing mode in order to do Wi-Fi on it. But it's pretty cool and uses the Meshtastic app on Android or iOS. And you can flash it basically just using a web browser. And note, you do not have to have a license to do this stuff, because it uses a unlicensed spectrum, 915 megahertz, so basically the same frequency that your old cordless phones used to run on. Back when we had landlines. I don't have a landline anymore.
Who does? I mean, statistically speaking.
Old people. I think my dad still does. And the guy at church, the session we started out, we had to start like groups of three people, and we're all going to be reading the Bible together, and not in the same place, you know. But we're checking, you know, we're supposed to check up each, on each other and all that. One of the guys in my group, I said, okay, is that phone number you gave me a mobile number? He's like, nope, that's a landline. I'm like, oh, really? I'm like, okay. Thankfully, the other guy I can text, so. But neither one of them, I mean, I think they both had email addresses, but the one guy couldn't even tell me what his email address was until he had to look it up. Fortunately, that's not as frequent as you might think in the church.
So did you see that stuff that Warren Beatty did?
Warren Beatty?
Yeah.
No.
Evidently, Warren Beatty owns the rights to Dick Tracy.
Oh.
And he's required every, in order to keep them, he's required every 10 years to, you know, produce some kind of television special or something. Something that makes it, you know, out there. He has to produce something in order to keep the rights because he wants to make a sequel. But the one of the companies that owned the rights to it tried to, you know, mess with his ability to make the sequel. So, yeah, out of petty revenge, he keeps making little makeshift sequels to prevent the rights from going to anybody else.
Interesting.
So what's going to happen now?
Nothing. He's going to keep sitting on rights until he actually decides to make a sequel. Or he dies. Actually, in, I think, what was it? 2027, the rights hit public domain and he can't stop it from there.
Oh.
Oh. I hate when people do that.
What, sit on the rights? Well, yeah. Like, literally this company tried to, because he had the rights to a sequel, and then this company tried to reclaim the rights and produce a television show or another movie, and or another movie, and he wouldn't allow it because it was supposed to be his. But Disney, who he had partnered with, decided that, you know, a sequel wasn't going to get made. And yeah, it spent until like 2009 wrapped up in the courts with this other company, the original owners of the rights, before Beatty.
I forgot who did the comic originally. Was it King Features? On the syndicate? I forget.
Hold on. The company that had
it? Yeah, the syndicate that, well, they had the publishing rights anyway.
Well, the publishing rights, I'm not sure. But the,
right.
The television and movie rights was.
Right.
Hold on, I'm looking it back up again. Possible sequel and issues.
So, the first.
Tribune Media Services.
Okay, yeah. Tribune is the syndicate. Yeah. I'm on the Wikipedia page. Chester Gould is the original author and artist, probably. And Mike Curtis is the current one, and Curtis Ettinger is the current artist. I always remember the two-way wrist radio from Dick Tracy.
Oh, yeah, I always wanted one of those, and now everybody has one.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I can make a phone call with my Pixel Watch.
Except no cameras on them. I mean, for a while they tried to put cameras on them, but I guess that just didn't work out well.
Well, that reminds me, like, in the late 80s... There was like an AT&T, not cell phone store, but a phone store at the mall that I used to go to in high school, and they had a camera with the phone with a camera on it, and it did the black and white video phone is what it was. I wish I remembered the model of it. Now, I always wanted one, but now I have one, and I'm on it every day. When you think about it, when you weren't on Zooms. All right, I suppose it's we can play us out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's time to wrap it up. I'm gonna play our promos and stuff. Promo. We'll see you in a week.
Yep.
Glad you had a good birthday. Thank you. Joel. Glad you were on More Dancing. Good to hear from you.
Nice to hear from you.
Always.
And Joe, as always, it's great to have you on too. We'll see you next week for episode 1048. Here it is.
I am short.
Oh my God.
It's Hacker
Public Radio.
Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Yeah.
Yum. Ooh. Wait, my head doesn't look right. Oh,
it was nice out today.
Did you work outside?
You know, one of these days I'm going to have to take the laptop downstairs. What I need to get for it is I need to get a. I don't know about you, but I'm like utterly hooked on working on multiple screens. Like, I'm on call this week, and I took my laptop with me to church and was taking care of some tickets here and there in between things. And I was just trying to lay everything out on your one screen, since I only had the one screen. Kind of a pain. Well, you're used to working on multiple screens all the time, and then all of a sudden you're not. That kind of sucks. So one of these days when it's nice enough out, I should go out. Well, I'll have to clean the table off, because even though it's in the screened room, it still gets rain and stuff in there. So the table is just full of dirt on it. So about once or twice a year, I'll completely clean it off with, I got some outdoor cleaner that works with it. But yeah, I have an outlet out there, so there's no reason I can't go out there and actually work. I might have to do that someday. But I want to get a portable screen I can bring with me out there, though. Or, well, I have a screen room, so I don't have to live with the mosquitoes.
Wait, what do you need a screen for then?
I don't. No, like a LCD screen.
Oh.
Yeah, that can hook up to the Thunderbolt board that I have.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They make lots of them. They're easy to get.
Yeah. I suppose I can. No, it doesn't have to be a really nice one. I can get another one that I could leave downstairs and bring it in when I'm not using it, if you know what I mean.
See, you know, the little toasters or nooks or whatever. And then they also have the first round of a tablet, which I'm waiting on.
Okay, I'm on their website right now. So the Starlight, Starbook, Starfighter. I don't need a question. Starbite. You have a Starbite?
No. The smaller laptop. I forget. I have the tablet coming. I got her the 14-inch, which has great battery life. The 16-inch is supposed to have like 18-hour battery life. And I'm not sure if I want to wait for that one or just order the 14-inch for myself now.
Look, if you don't want to wait, you can just order it and send it right to me, and I'll tell you how good it is.
the 14-inch or the 16-inch?
Yes. Both. Why not both?
The 16-inch they're behind on. Or they're right at putting them together, because they have so many options for CPU, GPU, memory, hard drive, and keyboard. You can get different language boards that they're behind on putting them together. There's a backlog. But wait, I really wanted the tablet.
I mean, the light has, like, you can't configure the memory option on that, but it's 16 gigs, so that's not bad at all. For $655, the light looks really nice.
The light is the tablet?
Is that a tablet? I thought the Starbook was, oh. No, wait. Let me go look at the Starlight. Oh, it is a tablet. Oh, no. It looks like a Jide killer.
What's Jide?
The Jide was this Android tablet that Joel and I both purchased. I'm going to say back in 2015, maybe early 16. Can't remember exactly when.
Can you put Linux on it?
Don't know. At the time, I don't think you could put Linux on it at the time. I don't know whether you can do it now. But it was a great little Android tablet that you could do a lot of stuff on it. And it was able to open up multiple windows at once, which was a big thing at the time for Android tablets. And it looked pretty much like this here. It had a removable keyboard. And it was really sweet. And when we got them, it was like close to the end of their life cycle, I guess. Cause they were only around then for like another couple of months. And then they just disappeared off the face of the earth. So there weren't any more updates to it, but it was a great device. I really enjoyed it. Now this would be just as awesome. It looks great.
Yeah, I have the Starlight ordered, waiting for it to be delivered. I maxed out everything on it.
Oh, yoy. Yeah, that was gosh, I'm gonna say, I think around that time, I don't even know when, how far this goes back. I know that there was a transitional period
with things like Netflix and all that, where you couldn't watch, even in the browser, Netflix movies on Linux, but then that got resolved. And I think it was roughly around that time. So probably one of the main advantages that I thought with being able to run Android was some of the apps that you couldn't get working on Linux. I guess maybe now, I don't know. Like I use it.
Time frame you're talking about.
Yeah, I use it as a comic book reader for a while and a Kindle reader type thing because it was like really nice for that. As well as, you know, it was a nice tool to have, which allowed me to SSH into my servers and, you know, whatever I needed to do. It functioned pretty well as a more powerful portable phone kind of device that didn't make phone calls unless you were using Mumble or whatever, a SIP phone or something like that.
Last year I bought a Galaxy 8 and used that as a phone and hotspot while I was in Thailand. And then I gave it to her. When I went back this year, I used it for my Wi-Fi hotspot again.
Galaxy.
But I just looked it up. MX is a collaborative effort between Anti-X and the Mepis community.
Mepis?
Former Mepis.
Holy man. Wait, who is this? Who are we talking about?
MX Linux. What I put on the laptop.
Oh, MMX. I was looking at, I thought you said XM Linux. MX Linux.
I might have said XM.
Okay, that makes more sense. There we go. Man, Mepis isn't around anymore, is it?
No, I don't think so.
What's up, Joe?
Not much. Finished up writing my show notes for this weekend's lit.
Alright, I gotta get this. We gotta start the show. Mordancy's been waiting. He's like, let's get this going here, man. What am I got going on here? No, that's not what I want. All right, you got that. Okay. I just moved all the files around, and now I don't remember what episode this is. I think it's 150. 1,047. Where did I get 150 from? All right. You're at. Okay. It's toasty here. Is it hot down there in Texas?
No, it's actually kind of chill, but we're also looking at thunderstorms and flash flood warnings down there.
Wow, it's muggy here. Muggy and pollenful.
When it warms up, it's going to be muggy again.
Yeah, I'll bet. Are you still in Ohio, Ordance? Columbus?
Yeah, I'm still in the same place.
Is it cold or warm there today?
I think it's 60 some degrees out, but the condo's hot.
It's 70 right now here. All right.